Well, welcome to the Brewhouse Show, Pat.
Hi, Calf.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's good. Episode 12?
Episode 12.
I got it right.
We're here.
We are here, yes. We are recording it on, I think, a week later than usual. I think you've been...
Not a whole week. 3 days.
It feels like a week because it wasn't last week.
It was not last week. Usually we record these on Friday afternoons, Friday mornings, and... Now we're Monday afternoon because I was sadly not feeling very well.
Sad face.
A little under the weather.
But it means that we're probably going to be full of energy because it's the start of the week and it's a Monday.
I'm still a little under the weather. And we just spent the first 3 hours moving desks.
Yeah, we just had... it's actually funny how we've been in this space for a while and we only occurred to us that we have like... a lot of space on a mezzanine floor, mm-hmm. and we're all cramming downstairs, and it's like, actually, we should just spread out a bit more. Yep. So that's kind of what we did today, and all it took was bringing on another person to prompt us to be like, hang on a minute, we should probably...
Number nine.
Yeah, so I'm sure we'll be talking more about that in the future. So today... I think, you know, first off, we've got a thanks to give to a listener who gave us a lot of feedback in a lovely email. I'd like to say that was one of many, but...
it was one of one.
Exactly. And we're going to be transparent about that. But thank you, Kelly, from Made by Uppercut, I believe.
Hello, Kelly.
Hi.
I was joking to Calv earlier that I used to be in a band called Hello, Kelly. And the premise was that our audience was Kelly, and we were singing songs to Kelly. And and so when Kelly came up in our email with a wonderful feedback email with just a bunch of great positive and negative feedback, it was nice. We had the idea that maybe we would do an episode entirely just called Hi, Kelly.
Yeah, we were. In fact, I'm still advocating for us to start every show saying "Hi, Kelly." but no, thank you for that. I think it was really good, and I did send a reply, and I'll send it. I'll say it to you now publicly through the podcast. I'd love to speak to you. I'm sure Pat would too. So let us know. And
if anyone else has feedback, please don't hesitate to shoot us an email. Either through or shoot us an email, calv@brewhouse.io or pat@brewhouse.io, or hit us up on Twitter @calv or @patdryberg, or @brewhouseteam is our team account.
Or phone me. I'm going to give my number again, 604-614-7784. Call me.
I can't wait for that first phone call.
I'm waiting because someone will call me and then they'll be like, you told me to call me. And I'll probably be like, did I?
You're like,
who are you?
Brushing your teeth, getting ready for bed. And you just hear the phone ring. It's an unknown number.
I'm like, what are you trying to sell me? I don't need to upgrade my shore. Go away.
Another one of those telemarketers. Oh, no.
But no, please do. We'd love to hear about you. And I think the email of feedback actually prompted us to the topic that we'd actually like to talk about today. I think, you know, Made by Uppercut are a product development agency very similar to us here at Brewhouse. And I think, you know, Kelly mentioned a couple of topics that touched on some of the things. And one of the things that we've been talking a lot about since starting 2016 is finding the right client. And, you know, what makes a good client, you know, what makes a good company. You know, and this is more than just money, you know, and you probably guessed listening to our previous podcasts, we don't work primarily on like revenue and like getting big high paying contracts. It's about impact of whether or not the product can deliver a real good quality to that business or our work can change their move their needle in some way. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
This is a conversation that I've had for a number of years because most of my career has been as a freelancer. And so for me, having the right client was always of paramount importance. And I always, you know, when I first was starting out in freelancing, I was often having these business these conversations with my father. My father was the easy way to say it is a mechanic, but he wasn't really a mechanic. He actually rebuilt engines for a living. or at least the latter part of his career. And he had a very different need for his clients. He just needed, you know, the client had an engine that needed to be rebuilt, and he rebuilt it. But he did have a couple things. One, he didn't remove engines from vehicles. He would get the engines delivered to him as just the engine. Mm-hmm. So that was one part of his criteria, and a few other things. But what was, you know, he had to have like a set schedule, like 9 to 5. He had off business hours so that people could bring him engines and so forth.
Yeah.
And so when we were having this conversation, you know, where we realized that, like, I didn't have those same limitations. Like, it didn't matter to me the times, because I worked whenever worked for me and whenever worked for my client. 95% of my clients were in the U.S. They weren't local, and I didn't have to go to an office. I just worked from home and so forth. Mm-hmm. But that meant that I had to set my own criteria. And so for me, number one was trust. Does the client trust me? Do they believe that I am an expert in this area, and that when I make a recommendation, it's not for my own personal gain or you know, like, I don't have any real skin in the game. It's not my business. My job is to provide professional advice and consultation to solve the problem that they're trying to solve. So does the client trust me? And the second part of that, or one of the big indicators to me for that, was, and I'd like to get your input on this, is what is their reaction when I tell them how much I charge?
Right.
and because I realized early on, and it was something, again, this is coming out of conversations with my father, my dad didn't want to be the bargain basement like guy. He wanted to do the high end, mid to high end work, mm-hmm. right? Of quality, which meant that he charged more than, say, like the guy down the street or whatever, who had like a shop in his backyard kind of thing. And so I had to understand from very early in my career that I was never going to, there were always going to be people who charged less than me, right? There's always going to be people who undercut my prices, whatever, whether it was an hourly or a project basis.
Yeah.
And so I had to, and so by setting a price and sticking to it, and then gauging the sort of potential client's reaction to that price, I just found through experience that the best clients I ever had were the ones who didn't bat an eye at the price.
So yeah, now we're going to probably change the topic of the conversation in the podcast to pricing work, because that's, so I've got a lot to say on that. Mm-hmm. But before I get into that, I'm just going to mention about trust. You had,
yeah.
So I think trust is a very good point, because software and design and products, it will always go wrong,
right
like it's like that, no, you know, like, so it's not like hunky-dory, you know, and you can't shove blame to anyone else. It's not like we're a car dealer, we're talking about cars, so that's what came to my mind, that we say, hey, here's your BMW, or, you know, I'm gonna go high class here, or Tesla, I should probably say, actually, we haven't said Tesla in the show for a while. Tesla, so here's your Tesla, and if it doesn't work or it wasn't of quality, it's not my fault, it's someone else's, right? So you have like the pass the buck. When you're the one building it and delivering it and working it, if there's something wrong with it, you're the one to blame. You're the one to question, like, why isn't it not right? And then the problem is that all software is broken.
Yeah.
It starts off broken until it can be better. And to be honest, it never is ever perfect. In the same way, design is never perfect. It's just the best at which it can be today that you feel, and it can always be better for a number of people. And then, so that kind of connects to a little bit to trust, because it's some of the things that I look for in a client. Do they understand software? And people, we talk about, oh yeah, well, you know, we prefer working with second time entrepreneurs versus first, but really what we're talking about is experience in software.
Right.
You could still find a first time entrepreneur, but happen to have built web software before, or witnessed it, or been in it. because they understand that. They understand that, like, yeah, like when you ship a line of code and or a web interface, even if you build it with WordPress, there will always be limitations. There will be things broken with it. And then that comes back to trust, because it's like, do they trust you to be working to the best of your ability and your skills and your ability to make it the best that it can be? And I've talked about this sometimes with clients, which is like when they say, oh, like, I don't understand the agile process. I don't understand like how, but are you going to deliver X? It's like, look, you're hiring the best team to build this for you that you can have on your bench working with you. So like, I can only guarantee that you're going to have the best efforts from the best team, like the skills, the experience, the knowledge, the insight, and everything else. And as far as, and then that leads to pricing, because it's like, and then we're priced competitively as you're going to go hire anyone else. And if you say, hey, you can get it cheaper, well, then that's not who we are.
Right.
So then I don't know, like my insight around like my response to you, like you want to hear my thoughts around pricing. I just feel like because we don't ludicrously charge. There are a number of other firms that charge way higher than what we charge. You know, we won't name names, but because we do that research to know, well, okay, where they are. And some people price based on reputation. You know, you know, we can charge this because that's we're sought after and demand. And we haven't changed ours. We haven't increased ours for almost a year actually now, and that's because I believe that that's our worth. And I have had advisors saying to us, you should charge higher now, you should charge a higher premium. And I'm like, well, do we need to? Why? You know, the why comes up, like, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, but going back to the point of the client, people that understand that that's how much you charge, and they know they've done software before, they can quantify it, they know how much it would cost them to go and hire and educate or find a CTO or build that out or find a creative individual to do all that. They know the time, the cost that's associated to that. They know that building a software project is X amount, right? That type. So when we give the quote and it's similar or thereabouts can be competitively analyzed, then they understand, they can figure it out. Whereas if someone looks at the number and goes, whoa, that's too much, all I know is that I can hire a junior developer out of X code school for 60K, or actually it's probably more like 30 because the people are paying ridiculous amounts these days. And I can go on, they can go make my code. They don't really fully understand software.
And therefore aren't really the right client for Brewhouse.
No.
So that's why I was getting like, again, regardless of what that number is, for pricing, and it's not the only criteria. It's not even like there were plenty of times, especially in my freelancing career, where I would say a price and they would be like, well, can you do it for this? And there would be other reasons why, like there would be other like, oh, I'm excited for this idea and I know this person and it's from a referral and there's other criteria to wait. Price was just an easy one to sort of be like, okay, well, like, I wanted it for, you know, I quoted, let's say $60 an hour or whatever it was. And they're like, well, we thought you could do it for 15. Well, no amount of excitement is going to get me, right?
I used to work, in fact, I can probably say, I don't think the guys would mind, when I was working at Go Free Range, we used to price based on level of interestingness and size of company and whether they're making money.
Yep.
Because, you know, and sure, it might be seen as douchey or like bad, but I found that I don't know what my takeaway from that, and I'm sure the rest of the team had different perspectives on it, but mine was generally that, like, I liked that we could, because at the time we wanted to work for the pleasure of working, like building great fun products. So if someone came to us and said, hey, I'm building, and in fact we did have one, it's like building like this Oyster card game, where every time you use the Oyster card, similar to Compass card, you check in and then you could play a game with it. So to check in as many stations, then you could kind of gamify people's exercise by saying if you get off a stop earlier and walk and stuff. And it was an amazing, it was a fun project. I think, you know, a lot of gamification and modeling and complications of data and getting the data from TFL. And anyway, we should probably think of doing something here for Compass Card. That would be hilarious. Get off a stop earlier and walk for half an hour, because it's the distances you're talking about here. But then we rated that as like, okay, this is really interesting. They haven't got as much money.
Yep.
So we could give a quota that falls in a different bracket. And then as a business, you know, how do you manage the monies and like that? Well, GoFreeRange is a little different. We kind of had fluctuating take home. We never had like salaries because we all used to freelance.
Yep.
We used to know. And then I think towards the end, we did balance it out as a regular income because people needed to know what they were getting and stuff. But anyway, today, like if you take that principle and then hypothetically say, if we all follow that model, we have highs and lows, and you figured out how to like have a balanced salary structure, then you could do that kind of risky stuff.
Yeah.
You could be like, hey, we're all comfortable.
Right.
You know, for the next 6 months, let's go do some crazy shit, you know, and sorry, I'm French, but like, you know, let's go do some, you know, fun projects. And oh, this came across the door and that's actually really that impact in the nonprofit world is huge there. Let's do that. Right. Because you could then take those risky moves. But anyway, going back to finding the right client, like money, my take on that around why to give a cost is, yes, partly to act as a filter to know, do they know, you know, and are they prepared? And then there is something to be said, like, yeah, we take our time to do things and that costs, right? Just, you know, mm-hmm. and the dedication and the focus you get when you work with us, what you're paying for. We don't do juggling of resources on different clients. We only ever take on two clients at a time or three clients, like for a reason. You have dedication. We don't overwork the team here because we're your team, right? Like there's a lot of logic then. And there are other people that do that. You know, I'm not saying we're unique in any way there, but that's why you pay that price. And I think if you kind of work for cheaper outfits and stuff, they also have models. Because how have they made that price work for them as a business becomes the question, right? In the same way, like if you buy a cheap t-shirt, like why is it cheap? We never question it. Some people do, but some people do. And like, well, this is cheap because it's some poor souls in some part of the world to make it for you because that's cheap. That's how it's cheap. So if you're trying to get a cheap deal on software, you should ask, well, what's going on in that company that allows me to make this solution that cheap?
Yeah, exactly.
What corners are they cutting? What quality are they not spending time on? What individuals are working on it? Is it outsourced? Like all these things come up, right? And you'd assume people would question that, but sometimes they don't. And anyway, it's fine. But
yeah. on your point about GoFreeRange, Sandwich Video, Adam Lissacore's company that does product videos for web, has a page called How It Works on their website. I'll link to it in our show notes, but he breaks it down. They basically have three tiers, and it's almost exactly what you were saying. Like there's like the indie developers and small bootstrap startups. And this is the first line here in the paragraph is these are nearest to our heart because this is where we came from. And so they have like a $1 sign for them. And then the next one is reasonably well funded startups, and they have two dollar signs. And the next one is big corporations, and they have $3 signs. And the point there is, and I actually hired them once to do a video for me, so I know how they work and how they structure their deals. They very much do structure deals based on not, you know, they have a price, they have like a cost associated with like production and so forth. And obviously like every commercial is going to have a different level of production. But then they also factor in, like you said, is this an interesting product? Is this going to be an interesting concept to shoot, to film, to write for? Do we get to work with cool people? Like, do we get to choose who the actors are and who writes the music and all that kind of stuff?
That's pretty cool,
right? And so it's very similar.
The last part's really interesting. Like, what flexibility do we have?
Mm.
Is an interesting measure.
Yes.
We don't do that. And that would be super interesting to think about. Because it's like, do we get to do the product design discovery? Do we get to do the decisions on like the interface? Or are you just prescribing those wireframes on us because you've figured that? Which is fine, mm-hmm. which is sometimes in cases it works. Mm-hmm. But obviously we prefer to work in a much more connected way without the knowledge that we're curing between both product and design, you know, development and design, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't do that. And that's actually really interesting. Like even down to the fact that like, oh, well, because I've said this about, I think you might've heard me in the past, like talking about new product building versus like supporting those that are already at growth yep. stage. It's a very different type of work. Mm-hmm. And a different pace as well. Mm-hmm. And the pace is different. Like coming into a code base and trying to get to terms with not only the business domain, you have to get a knowledge of the code, you have to get a knowledge of the design, like let's talk about the CSS. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things to get up to speed about, yep. which is a lot more of a heavier piece of work mm-hmm. than rolling a new, a fresh, kind of like we can just start it.
Sort of everyone coming to an understanding together.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly. Let's like, go, like you're walking.
Especially when a product discovery or design.
You're starting the greenhouse. Yeah. You know, it's like, okay, well, there's nice, we can put the nice new bedding in there. We can plant the seeds correctly. We can irrigate them correctly. We can do everything that we want nice and perfectly. Whereas like when you're coming into someone else, it's like, yeah, we took them out of the greenhouse long ago. They're planted over there in that bush at the back. It's like, oh, crap. Mm. So we have to get to that, like yeah. dig through all this stuff and then go, are they, you know, like, is it growing that well? It's like this completely different thing. I'm not saying they're all like that, but like it's very mm-hmm. rare that like you walk into something mm-hmm. that's all new and shiny. But then that's what people hire us for because we're good at it. We can parachute in, you can firefighting as some people will call it, and then we clean it up and make it all good and then like alleviate the pain for the client. And we've done that for a number of our clients, and we actually do enjoy doing it, right? But it's that, you know, different perspective on those two things. It's kind of interesting.
Leads to another somewhat related idea around the right client, new clients versus existing clients. Because there's trade-offs, right? With a new client, generally it's like, oh, the excitement of learning a new thing. And
yeah, and we've been talking about this a lot, actually. Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
coming in and gaining new understanding of a new industry or just product space or what have you, versus an existing client, whether it's working on the same product that we either helped build the MVP for, or we've just done some development and code review in the past and they want something else. There's trade-offs, and I think back, like, again, some of the best clients I had were like just one off, you know, they were hired for me for one thing and that was it, and you know, shake hands at the end and away they go, and they have a great life after that, and I'm happy with the paycheck or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, on the other hand, one of my favorite clients in my freelancing days was this guy Sean Blanc, who is a writer and runs a number of websites. I designed a couple things for him. And what was great, especially the second project, was like there was none of the, like, we knew each other. We didn't have to go through the same, like, he knew how I worked. He knew how I build. He knew how I, right? And so there was a lot of those introductory easy ramp up. Levels.
It's like, exactly. This is what you need to know here. I've provided that yeah. for you, Pat. And like, yeah. here's, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. But then there's still, is this an interesting project? Is this an interesting, you know, am I like passionate about what it is that you want me to do?
The clients where that's worked well for me depend on a number of things. Mm-hmm. One of them being, do they really truly listen to you?
Right.
Goes back to trust. Like if I say to a client, yeah, like we can work together, but listen, like, you know, it's the typical thing of you proposing to a big board to open up budget to do things, right? It's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you know, next time we work on this area, we better definitely consider X, or it's technical debt, right? Let's call it that as one thing. And design debt is the same thing. But like, you've cut corners here to ship it, or I have cut corners to ship it for you. And I gave you those options. And you need to decide what we're going to do next time. And I can't keep putting that off, right? Or we can't keep putting that off. And I think that those clients that then say, hey, you know, like, that was awesome. Can you do it again? Like, or can you, and they have that, it's timeline of like, oh, well, you did it fast first off. And the second time it's longer. I think, you know, we're smiling because we've, you know, we've had these situations where it's like, you say to a client, it's like, okay, this is how long it's going to take the second time around. And then they're like, oh, like, should it not be cheaper? Like I put a lot of money in it the first time around. It's right. like, no, like that was
yes. Yeah. Yeah. much scope. And now you're looking for twice the scope.
It's yeah. not gonna be, yeah. And it's exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, but then that also the second scope means having to revisit areas and that this relates to that comment that most clients that don't understand software come back to, which is, I need to tell you about everything this needs to do so that it's prepared for everything that needs to do, you know, like that. Yeah, no, I know we're not doing that in this milestone, but you need to know about that, because when we get to that, I don't want to know that, like, oh, it can't be done. Like, that's the fear, right? Well, you know, and then it's so hard to say, like, look, it's easier for me to just tell you the truth. It can't be done. Hmm. Like, it doesn't matter what preparation you do now. It's like, unless you get to that, then you will know the state that you're in. You can't predict the future.
Exactly.
And it's like, you know, it's like, well, we can guess, and I can tell you something to make you feel better, but that's not the truth. Mm. Anyway, it's funny when you think of that. But yeah, I don't like pricing. I'm rewinding a little bit here. Like, what else do you think matters when finding a perfect client or a good client? I mean, actually, you know, when we talk about, so we've had to ask this question, then what is a good client, right? And you know, and I guess now, you know, let's talk about other agencies and other people. Like, I'm interested to know how they do this, but what would you say a good client is, or even the things, yeah, like that people wouldn't assume are qualities that a client should have,
mm.
that ones that we've worked with in the past have had as good qualities,
mm.
other than, you know, we've talked about trust.
Yeah. So we've talked about trust. We've talked about experience. I think, a willingness to learn would be one, right? Like, especially that, and that's quite frankly, like, pretty easy to spot. You can kind of see in a first, like, hour long meeting, like, is this person listening, or are they just like waiting for their turn to speak? That sort of thing, right? Where it's they're not, I guess, really is like, are they asking me questions, right? Are they asking things of me? To better understand how I work, yep. what I need out of this relationship, et cetera, right? It is, though the money is coming to me, the value is going to them. And so it is a two-way relationship. Yeah,
and the more they provide or engage, mm. the higher the value is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's a really
good... Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think being humble is one of the things that I put... And I think that goes back to... I keep on saying going back to you, but collaboration, we didn't mention it actually, mm. but collaboration, to collaborate, you need to be humble. You need mm-hmm. to know that, like, you don't know everything. And if we try to create a collaborative effort to build some software, we're acting as your team. We have to assess you as, are you a team member?
Right.
Which means then what are our values, and do they follow our values?
Mm.
You know, and are they transparent? Do they collaborate? Mm-hmm. Do they think the way we think? Because the projects that have come out really well with us are those that have adopted that or are like-minded in that way. Those that clash perhaps with the transparency part is a good example. And they haven't really fully told us the story, or haven't mm-hmm. really revealed all the data. And then, like, towards the end of the project, it's like, oh, I'm only doing this because of this, or our goal is to get to this. And yeah. he's like, what? Like, if you told us that at the start, yeah. and like, you know, what? Anyway, so, yeah. You know.
Because they don't think, like, it was needed, or they just didn't, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And and there's different reasons for different.
Sure.
But I think, but associating your values on your mm-hmm. client.
Yep.
Is, I think, something that we do hugely implicitly.
Important. Absolutely. Yeah. The last one for me, and I say this because I can think back on projects that ultimately didn't go as well as I'd hoped they would, but looking back, I don't regret them, and that is working with a client who was passionate.
A dreamer?
Not necessarily a dreamer, but someone who, when... How do I put this? There are people who are like just, you know, kind of, they're passionate at the beginning because they are, you know, like it's like a new idea and they get excited by a new idea. But the difference between those clients and the clients who are still as passionate when things aren't going well, who are still like more like...
I still classify that as a dreamer.
Yeah, maybe.
They're not realistic. They don't understand where they are. Like, because you mean like in the sense that like, the typical entrepreneur is like, it's all going amazingly well. And
not necessarily that I don't mean that they're looking at it through rose colored glasses,
okay.
but that they still believe that a solution is possible.
Right.
That, sure. A, it may take more time. It may take more money. It may take a different, you know, turn of approach or what have you. But it's that willingness and that acceptance of like, and I think you kind of got at this too, like, again, around the understanding of how software and products are built.
Yeah.
But just like, I can think of like certain clients in my past, especially where, you know, just things weren't going how we expected. And rather than coming down on me as the freelancer, as the consultant,
you're the one that creates the solution.
They're still engaged and they're still like, yeah, we can work this out. Like, we can figure this out. It's not a problem. You know, like where they, it's not a, where every situation that, or every roadblock isn't a do or die, you know, it's just like, oh, it's just a roadblock. We'll get through it, you know, and we'll plug on. Whereas just some clients that I don't think are nearly quite as passionate about either their product or even their, you know, just what they're doing is like, once they hit that roadblock, it's like, oh, geez, I can't, I mean, I just can't, like, what are you doing? You know, they, and it's just a very different, the way they approach problems is very different.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever experienced that probably. Like specifically what you're getting at. I know what you're getting at, but I've never, I think, I'm trying to think of it. Like, yeah, the only way I can relate to it in my experience is I've had those that don't choose not to believe what we're saying, telling them.
Sure.
You know, like that, like, listen, like, it doesn't matter if we spend 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever, building that out based on your data that, you know, this is not the right thing for you to do, or, or like, hey, improve this interface. No one's using my product. Let's dumb it down to that. Like, I've launched my product. My app's out there. Why isn't people using it? Fix it. It's like, well, it's not as easy as that, right? Like, we're not magicians. If we knew that, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's like, but, you know, it's like, yeah. So you do tell us, and then they might give us an idea or like off the cuff ideas they maybe heard this morning or read on a blog post. And it's like, well, that's not good enough. Like, you know, you need to think that through a bit more. Like, you're about to throw X amount of cash to us to do that. And then you're going to say, why didn't it work to us? I can relate to that scenario. That's happened before. Mm-hmm. And in the past, there have been times where I'm like, okay, let's do that. And then at the end of it, regretting it, because it's like, regret in the sense of regretting the decision. Our work is always, you know, happy as best we can be, but that we sunk X amount of time in, the client's happiness is not to the full extent that it could have been because they attached the success of their random idea on us versus the quality of the implementation of that idea.
You know? Yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
I don't know. I said dreamer because it's that like new idea every week.
No, I've experienced that for sure.
Yeah.
You know,
or even like every day,
yeah,
every hour,
yeah.
There they are in Slack. Hello,
yeah.
Just thinking,
yeah.
Just saw this, and you're like, ah,
no. It's more for me. It was more just the optimist, I guess, is maybe more better way of saying it. You know, the person who, even in the face of things not going well, still believe that through perseverance and I've experienced this as well, who are just willing to accept that, like, okay, well, this didn't work, we got to nip it in the bud and try a different path or try something completely different.
Yeah. And I think there is, I think that leads to perhaps another challenge with finding the right client, which is like, we talked about the balance between business decisions versus product decisions.
Yeah.
You know, I think, yes, we are a part of your team. Perhaps we have insight on that market, that vertical, and perhaps we've worked on a product in that space before. But that does not, you know, make us your founders or make us a part of your exec team or directors to give you guidance. And I feel that sometimes creates tension and issues. And in the past, we've had to say to some clients, look, you know, I think you need to do more business value workshops or try and understand your value that you're trying to provide to your users or customers before, you know, coming to us. And, you know,
those aren't always the funnest conversations.
They're not, but like, it's like a polite no. But the good news is that we have a ton of people we help forward them onto, right? So,
and quite frankly, it, to me, like, when you don't build trust with a client when you say yes to things.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. You build trust with them when you say no, when you admit your limitations, right? When you say like, that is not a decision for me to make. That is a decision for you to make. And if you don't have the information, we will gladly point you, try our best to point you in the direction to find that information. But it's
a balance, that's the limit right? But of like, because you know, like, so I've been hired as a CTO for hire in the past, and it's this, and I'm conflicted. Like, it works, it does help. It's helped some businesses. Those that have had my time have found it of serious, tremendous value. It's helped them get a team in place. It's helped them get improve a team, even right. And but it's a marathon you're running, right? And I think that's the problem. When you make a decision like that, or you give advice, it's like, you know, I'm telling you to do this strategy because you're going to run for like eight months, 12 months, two years, 3 years, 5 years. It's a long slug. And I'm giving you a bit of an adjustment on that little, that marathon you're running there. And like, you should take that as a pinch of salt. Mm. Like, I'm not running the marathon.
Yeah.
I didn't start it. I'm not going to be in it with you in that time frame. Like, so I really don't care if like I'm chaffing and I should have put Vaseline on or whatever. Like, you know, it's completely different. And I think, and so when I, so even with advisories now, like, people ask me to be advisor all the time. I'm like, I'll help you now. I'll gladly help you. Yeah, sure. I'll kick myself if I don't get a return right now. But unless I'm helping you continuously for like 2 or 3 years, and I feel that I can help you for that period of time, then I will talk about that, right? Whereas if I can just help you now for the next X amount of months, because that's the stage of your company where I'm value, then I'll help you. I'll gladly help you. It's no problem, right? Like, because people have done that to me. Mm-hmm. And I find that the best advisors I've had in the past are those, versus the ones that are like, hey, here's a here's an advisory agreement, and please give me X amount of equity before you give you my advice. It's like, well, all right. Anyway, but dissecting that further, I'm just like, saying no to a client does like build trust. But then I was going to mention, when you were saying that, there have been a past where we said no to a client a number of times, but they only made them want us more. Right. And then we're like, no, like, no, we're seriously, like, I know. And then they'll do what's required and come back, and and you just have to deal with that, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like the when I was a camp counselor. This is an interesting lesson that I didn't really think about until right now, until you mentioned this. the lesson of or else. So if you tell someone to do something, right, go make your bed, or else I will do this, you're giving them the option to not do that thing, right?
Yeah.
And so, and it's like, oh, well, or else I just have to sit in this corner for an hour. I'll sit in a corner for an hour if I don't have to make my bed.
I think you've just, right? You've just nailed it on the head with my disciplinary with our kids right now. We're doing it all wrong.
Right? Because as soon as you give them the option, it means they can take that option, right? And there's almost no way that you can make that second option as bad as like...
Well, with kids, if you give them option A, you're like, okay, these are the options. Yes. You're doing this, this, or this. Mm. They're like, oh, well, there are options. Do you know what happens with our kids? They're like, well, what about this option? You didn't say this option.
Yeah, even the idea that there are options.
Exactly. Whereas if you just said, actually, no, this is
so happening. As a camp counselor, we had to be very diligent about just saying, this is what we're doing.
Yeah,
we would say why. We're happy to give a reasonable explanation, but this is what we're doing. And so to get back to your like saying no to a client and then for XYZ reason, and then they come back having solved that, and then we're like, oh, actually now there's this reason, right? It's just kind of...
I think let me just be clear here though. If there's a no for the wrong reason, like let's be frank here. If there's like a client we just don't like,
sure.
Like, this person is just can't work with them, really, really hard to work with. We are still not fully transparent to say that to them, right?
It's hard to say that.
Right? It is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really to be like, it's, you know, so have you ever been in a situation where you've had to? You've had to, and you just go, look, you're a dick. I'm not working with you.
Yes, I have.
right? So, but you gave them a chance though first, right? You'd say something, and you're like, did they get the hint? Did they get the hint? But then you finally just have to be like, look,
I had to.
I can't work with you. Yeah. So I've done the same.
Yeah.
Right. We've had even a client here at Brewhouse actually that we just had to be like, you know, after you what you put us through, blah blah blah. Like, you know, no way we'll ever talk to you, kind of thing. And that's very rare for me. Like, it takes a lot. And even still, they would come back, and I'll still help them. Mm-hmm. but there is a point where it's like, actually, look, yeah, like there is a line, and that goes back to values.
And so that's actually how I would almost phrase it. There's a line that we established at the beginning of this relationship, and you cross that line. Right?
But some people think that's fine. There are those clients that say, well, that's the way I treat my barista at Starbucks. I'm not saying it.
And then it's just a matter, you know, that gets back to like respect and trust and all that.
But we're doing well at trying to refine this view of our client. Mm-hmm. I think our challenge now is whittling down the list. I think, you know, there are a number of clients that then fit this. That's, you know, let's talk about even our situation now. We have probably more leads than we've had for a while as a company, but are they the right fit? Probably less so, probably because of timing, because of other things, etc. Some just want, you know, a certain part of the offering and not the whole thing. And it's like, here's a question to you, like, when do you let go as an agency? And I'm sure people that are listening to this, if they are running an agency, will be thinking the same. Like, when do you let go of the perfect world of a client before you start saying, we just have to take that?
So that gets into an interesting conversation, because I think, as we were saying, when I was mentioning the pricing thing, like, I just don't know that there is a perfect client. And maybe that's part of it, right?
It's just
acknowledging like there is no perfect client. It's always a series of compromises. And so, like I was saying earlier, around like I might say a price, and then they might come back to me and say, "Well, can you do it for this price?" I have to wait. Okay, is the project interesting? Is it going to have an impact? Is it
so? Appropriate. So we just spent how long have we spent talking about this?
Like, half an hour
to talk about finding the right client. We just said actually
there isn't really one. But it's a to me, I would say this of anything. What matters most to me is, does this client trust me, and do I trust the client?
Yeah.
And
you know what's funny about saying that, Pat? That's the same that applies to friendship.
Yep.
That's the same that applies to relationships in life.
Father, son, father, daughter,
whatever. Like it's that's what builds us as people, right? Yep. And I think that's very poignant in the sense that even like marriages are never perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships are never put you to all the given, it's a compromise, it's a balance. But what builds it together is the trust.
Yep.
Is very interesting.
Yep.
So, well, I think that's a really apt way of ending.
I think so.
The conversational topic. But, you know, I completely agree with you. It makes complete sense. Like that's the truth, because we've even done that in the past where we said we will face clients like this again.
Yes.
And they are people.
Mm-hmm.
And they want us, and we can help them.
Mm-hmm.
So let's figure out how to make it work. And you've heard me say that a number of times.
Yep.
And it's like, because that's who people are. And so interesting. All right, product of the week. Do we have anything to
highlight?
You don't have anything?
No, sorry.
All on me.
All on you.
Peach. Let's talk about peach.
I haven't even looked at it yet.
You haven't even loaded Peach up?
No, Pat? I've heard it's not very, like, apparently it's some sort of new social network without a timeline, and you have to, like, look at a person's page or something or other. I don't know. It doesn't, I don't know. I don't know. No interest.
I don't know. So, Peach, so it's, and I'll show you as I'm demonstrating you the product. It's a social network.
Mm-hmm.
So I can add my phone number and it connects me with people within my address book. So you can't do that with Twitter anymore since they kind of locked that stuff down. I can add friends. But what's really interesting is the view, there's the first view that you see is yourself at the top and your friends and just one, the latest status update. And I mentioned this to...
Ordered by time.
Recent, right? Yeah. And so it goes back to a concept of something that I enjoyed with Twitter originally was like, what are you doing right now?
Yep.
Was the question or something of that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, it was a status update. It was a status update. Status update in the true sense of it. Not, I'm going to post about this
right.
article mm-hmm. or my views of the world or whatever. So then when you scan down, you'd see updates from your friends and yep. you'd see what they were doing and see what they were working on, whatever. And I can actually remember tweeting like that when it started. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what I was doing. Yep. Sort of. Now, new people sign up for Twitter, they don't do that. Nope. It's not a thing. Whereas here on Peach, it is that. And so you get a lot of updates from people around what they're doing, and you get to scan down very quickly. Sure, people aren't doing that now. Now they're just dumping their brain. But still, to digest that, it's far easier by just looking at the first thing. I like that. I like that. Anyway. And I only just because I know that there is some magical thing about that in the sense of seeing like a quick view. Mm-hmm. I still don't think this is it, though. Like, I want to see groups. So Mike, I had a concept very similar to this, and I called it group view as something just to put notes underneath. And group view was like a grid of faces. Mm. And I could swipe left or right through these groups of people. So I'd have like my, you know, team, the people that I'd have my family. And then I'd swipe, and then it'd have like maybe the people that I drink with, maybe mm-hmm. the people that I do sports with. Like, I'd have these different views. And then that way I can kind of get a snapshot of these groups mm-hmm. of people. And I'm sure, you know, friends groups don't exactly work directly in groups, but the purpose was just to see like a quick update.
Yep.
How is everyone today? Where are they? What are they up to? So I can still stay in touch. Mm-hmm. Like, I like that element. So that presence, when I say presence in the sense of like, I am, you know, I used to set a presence notification is interesting, because you can do little things like type in a keyword like weather or location or move, and they've got loads of little keywords to pull in like status like data.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do, of course, you can do GIF, right? You can type in GIF and then search GIFy, I'm
sure. Not a social network without GIFs.
No, and it's an emojis and all that other jazz. But the interface and the tech of it, it's terrible.
Is it? That's what I had heard, that especially the interface, like, just bugs galore. And
yeah, oh, yeah. You know, I mean, like, you tap on a button, I get a friend request, I have to tap through to three things to get to it. You can see, like, it's a bad implementation when, like, the notification just sends you to the homepage, not to a specific area of the app.
Oh, really?
Right, so that's if you get a friend notification, you click on it, it just opens up the app. And then you have to go through two screens to get to but that's fine.
Is it?
It is, because it's working. They've created a whatever value or behavioral hook has overcome the barriers of adoption, of like that difficulty to use it, because the value outweighs like that difficulty. Because
it does.
But say if you reversed it, say if you made it an amazingly intuitive app that did this, but like missed the feel, or the brand wasn't warm, or the connections of the friends, the uptake wasn't there, it wouldn't work. Whereas if you got it out there quick and dirty, and you got it working, and like people were interacting with it because they wanted it so badly, or their friends said you would need it, because that's what happened, right? Like, I've got told about it, or seen all these people talking about it, like, I better check this out. So I sat there for 5 minutes or whatever, setting it up, connecting with people, and now still using it. The values provided, it's shown me in some way, and now I'm like, oh, well, that worked, right? Do you see what I'm getting at?
No,
like, it's that Craigslist thing. People will still use Craigslist because it looks like crap.
Yep. But it works.
But it works.
Yeah.
Anyway, Peach, that's my... Babble about Peach.
Cool. I have nothing to add. Well, thanks for chatting with me, Calvis.
No worries. Thanks for chatting with me, Pat. And we'll talk again.
For sure.
Thanks, listeners. Bye.
Bye.